Christians to support a united Jerusalem. United meaning exclusively Israeli, not united in the way we would understand. We, the undersigned Christian spiritual leaders communicating weekly to more than 100 million Christian Americans, are proud to join together in supporting the continued sovereignty of the State of Israel over the holy city of Jerusalem. We believe Jerusalem, any portion of it, should not be negotiable in the peace process. Jerusalem must remain undivided as the eternal capital of the Jewish people. You hear this mantra all the time, but notice how they end their advert. Join us in our holy mission to ensure Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel. Moving the US Embassy to Jerusalem is a holy mission.
And Donald Trump, apparently he's on it, Martin.
Except that he's about to back down because he's suddenly realised that he's escalating and he doesn't know what the end of it's going to be.
Also, there's this massive settlement programme just started. That will help things in East Jerusalem, won't it?
No, it won't. And of course, if he keeps pushing this pro-Israeli line, he's going to come into conflict with the Syrians and the Russians. So he's not making peace with them either.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Cabinet Member for...
This
no, actually no, it wasn't again. A Cabinet Member at all. It was Vari Threlf also to Jackson Moulding. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
When it comes to great stakes, I've just raised the stakes. The Sharper Image is one of my favorite stores with fantastic products of all kinds. That's why I'm thrilled they agree with me. Trump steaks are the world's greatest steaks, and I mean that in every sense of the word. And the Sharper Image is the only store where you can buy them. Trump steaks are by far the best-tasting, most flavorful beef you've ever had, truly in a league of their own. Trump steaks are five-star gourmet, quality that belong in a very, very select category of restaurant, and are certified Angus Beef Prime. There's nothing better than that. Of all of the beef produced in America, less than 1% qualifies for that category. It's the best of the best. Until now, you could only enjoy steaks of this quality in one of my resort restaurants or America's finest steakhouses, but now that's changed. Today, through the Sharper Image, you can enjoy the world's greatest steaks in your own home with family, friends, anytime. Trump steaks are aged to perfection to provide the ultimate in tenderness and flavor. If you like your steak, you'll absolutely love Trump steaks. Treat yourself to the very, very best life has to offer. And as a gift, Trump steaks are the best you can give. One bite and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And believe me, I understand steaks. It's my favorite food. And these are the best.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you speak? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligence Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart of the original.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente de Indigena.
Sorry to interrupt, but is it possible for John perhaps to answer one or two of those?
Certainly,
points?
Certainly.
Otherwise, we're going to have
certainly.
9 points unanswered.
But, yes, it's building up the list a bit. But I mean, the problem that we have got is that you think that we're ridiculing Jesus, and we say, sort of sincerely and truthfully, that is certainly not what we intended to do, and I believe that we're not. And I can best answer that, I think, by answering. His question, which is that what were we trying to do? And I think it comes out, it was spelled out perhaps rather too plainly, rather too banally at one point, when he says, make up your own mind, don't let other people tell you. And we would absolutely deny, at least I would, that there was any attempt to say you should not believe in Christ. What we're saying is take a critical view, find out about it. Don't just believe because somebody tells you to. Somebody in the pulpit says something, question it, work it out yourself.
You're seriously suggesting that if someone saw that film, say a young kid who knew nothing about the Gospels or about history, that the figure of Christ that would emerge from it, this story of the Incarnation, would be a noble one, would be...
He would have to sort it out for himself.
And,
he would have to, for example, work out, I mean, does one accept every word in the Bible? In a Sermon on the Mount, did they get it all right when Mark wrote it down 30 years later? I mean, was...
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Internet radio for smarter than original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salaton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under colonial, imperial, theological, racialist, homophobic, misogynist, neoclassist, neoliberal, neoliteral, neo-fascist governments and societies, and those communities suffering from pro-capitalist anti-environmental oppression. I'm your host, The Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com, and along with my executive co-producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales. We welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in Multnomah Nation Territories. yeah, where are we supposed to go today with the news that we are dealing with today? It is entirely shameful. It is entirely embarrassing. It is entirely strange that we're at the political conundrum that we're in. I mean, on our way into the studio today, we found out via Democracy Now!, which we advise you to check out at democracynow.org. We consider ourselves partners of theirs. They've sent us news items. We've sent them information over the years. Various producers that work for Amy Goodman, who is, you know, I have to say, the hardest working independent journalist in the United States, you know. And one of the reasons why I'm saying this, the way I'm saying this, and why I'm saying this now, is because, you know, the politics in the U.S. are really getting fucked up. I mean, it's really gotten twisted. And we're letting, if I can channel John le Carré a little bit, one of his main characters, George Smiley, you know, made it when he was describing how Carla, you know, his main antagonist in the KGB, you know, Putin's old crew, right? Of course, this is entirely fictional, but, you know, this is really what was going on during the Cold War. That basically, his mole was right up to the top. Not at the top, but right up to the top. You know, the reason being, you know, again, some of us who are considered to be old school lefties and fellow travelers, you know, all of that crazy shit that Whitaker Chambers was talking about. Whitaker Chambers, Nixon, because that's how he made his bones, right? Red baiting like that. Reagan's not his first wife. His first wife was Jane Wyman. When he married Nancy, her father was a rabid anti-communist, you know, because Reagan wasn't like that. When he was head of the Actors Guild, I know a lot of you don't know that and probably wondering what the fuck I'm bringing this up for, but I'm just saying Ronald Reagan got swayed, you know, like the rest of us, you know, he was swayed by a female. And she was like, hey, look, you know, listen to my father and his politics and forget, you know, your pretty much open attitude towards communism and so on. Now, what am I talking about with that? What am I talking about with that one? You know, I know a lot of, because Lupe's looking at me kind of crazy right now, too, because we're not going to be in here that long. Excuse me, we're not going to be in here alone, but, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, frankly, I don't even know what the fuck I was going to talk about. That's how crazy shit is. You know, I mean, the political situation in the United States is so nutty, is that you have the far right, the alt-right, you know, there's all these new terms now, right? You know, to confuse things. You know, the neo-Nazis are fucking neo-Nazis. The fact that some of them are hipsters, you know, calling them alt-right is bullshit because it confuses the situation, which is what the fuck they want, which is why they're not acting like Sieg Heiling Nazis unless it's, you know, amongst each other and they forget that the camera's there, because that's what happened with Richard Spencer, you know, who just got clocked not too fucking long ago on camera, and it turns out that he was actually hit twice that goddamn day. That wasn't on film, right, Luke? That wasn't on film. Somebody photographed that. We definitely posted it somewhere on one of the sites over there, maybe my own personal site. Check me out, aboriginalwriter.wordpress.com. You can also check me out on Twitter, The Angry Indian, one word. It's like, what do we do with fascism right in your face? We have Stephen Bannon, who somehow was able to maneuver the national security people. I mean, the people who are really supposed to give the president that 7 o'clock briefing every morning. But I understand now that Trump has moved it to 9 o'clock. Because I suppose he's sitting up watching telly. So, you know, he's, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. He's not ready for that, you know, for that call. And yeah, you know, Hillary Clinton said the same thing. You know, will he get up at 3 o'clock? You know, will he get up? You know, will he be ready to do that talking about Obama? And then here we have Trump, who, yeah, I mean, the hypocrisy is, I don't even know where to begin with this. I don't even know where to end with this. It's crazy. I mean, we have the far right, if you, at least on Twitter anyway, because I'm not on Facebook. I don't give a fuck about Facebook. I'm starting to not give a fuck about Twitter. Really, it's getting to that point. Because you had people who were saying that Obama was playing golf when he should have been in the White House, when George W. Bush admitted that he didn't go to the White House as much as he was supposed to in terms of a natural work week, and that he was playing golf all the goddamn time. He's on film with this, saying that his critics didn't understand what the, you know, the idea or the definition of work really was. I can't remember, and do you remember, Luke, which Michael Moore documentary that was? Because that's where I saw it. That's the first time I saw it, because after that, there were websites, you know, left-wing websites that had, yeah, they all cited that particular thing. I'm supposed, if you're really interested, dear listener, I suppose you can go on YouTube and you can find it, but regardless. So then they turned that whole golf bullshit against Obama when it came to Trump. But Trump actually owns golf courses in which he knocks down, you know, average working class Scottish people. He moves and, you know, all of their fucking homes out of the way. You know, he pushes their factories and shit out of the way. Because I understand there was a factory that was moved. This is what I was told by somebody who has family in Scotland. If it isn't true, then hey, let me know. Fourth World Radio at gmx.pt if you want to email us. Number 4, TH, World Radio, as it sounds, at gmx.pt. I know it was strange, but if you're following us at aboriginalradio.wordpress.com, you'll have access, you know, in terms of these email addresses. Drop us a line. We want to hear from you. We really do. Yeah, I mean, if someone has, you know, information to the contrary, I would definitely, you know, check it out. But, you know, but that's the thing. Are we actually checking out the information that we're getting? Now, I don't want to be in here too long because I really think that Lupe has some audio that we all need to listen to, even though we've played it before. It's worth a repeat because we have a lot of new listeners. And, you know, they're not always, you know, not willing, but you know, who has the time really to go through a lot of, you know, all these old shows? So we're gonna play it again from Brother Daruba Bin Wahad. Now, you know, I've been compared to him in some cases by people who have listened to him and they've heard me. Well, he's older than me, but we come out of the same political milieu. You know, like I said, my family was involved in the Black Liberation Movement. They just didn't talk shit. They were actually involved. And, you know, those after that particular period, after what they deemed the revolutionary period, same thing with the Deacons for Defense, which I also have family members that had some connection to that. Because, you know, the underground, we've talked about this on this show. Geronimo Pratt, the late Geronimo Pratt, who passed in Tanzania after he went through the horrors that he did. He was framed by COINTELPRO. That's how most of us in the Black community actually know anything about COINTELPRO. Same thing with Daruba Bin Wahad. The reason we know about COINTELPRO is because he won his case against the Federal Bureau for Investigations. You know, investigations, Bureau for, you know, Intimidating Aboriginals. You know, you can put it however you want to, you know, or that's the BIA, right? Sorry, Luke, you know, thanks for correcting me on that. But, you know, what? Federal Bureau for Intimidating Aboriginals. Yeah, well, look, whatever. No, we're not cool with the BIA over here either. I mean, what the fuck, man? You know, the BIA, you know, sat by, or actually was part of, was complicit in the sterilization of two generations of Native American people in North America. See, now, that's a conspiracy. That's not a fucking conspiracy theory. That's a conspiracy. Which brings me, because Lupe's, you know, twirling her finger. Yes, that brings me right back around. I'm sorry about the tangents. But roll with me, brothers and sisters. you know, one of the things I suppose I want to talk about before we hear the Rubber Bin Wahad on various subjects is that a lot of people in the black community, and, you know, this is a real problem. Now, I've written about this in the mismeasures of, you know, revisionist Afrocentrism, and there were a lot of people who really got emotional with me. They weren't being logical with me. They were getting emotional with me because, first off, a few of them who should know better asked me questions what the fuck revisionism meant. Like, they couldn't look it up, and they have no concept of this in terms of, you know, Holocaust revisionism or in terms of slavery revisionism, trying to change, you know, things around in terms of African slavery in the Americas to the transatlantic slave trade, then the triangular trade. How you use language depends on how the information gets across and how it's understood. Do you follow what I'm saying? You know, just like a lot of people, you know, yeah, I mean, you can tell by their accent, you know, more or less, or how they speak, you know, what the fuck you're dealing with. Just like when you're listening to me, I make no bones about it. I have no fucking shame in this. Uncle Tom / assimilationist, call me what the fuck you will. You know, I used to yo and do like a lot of fucking people, but once I left my goddamn neighborhood and I traveled, you know, getting a passport makes a big motherfucking difference in your life, man. Leaving the United States, being able to see your community from the outside, being able to see your people from the outside, being able to hear political opinions from different fucking people and to really see how this shit connects. You can't do that if you never leave where the fuck you are. You can't. You can read all the books, you can watch all the fucking things, you know, but even then, you will read the books in which you have access to. You will look at the documentaries in which you have access to. If you can even call these fucking things lately documentaries, they're mostly docudramas. They're not about information at all. It's about presenting an opinion and trying to convince you that this opinion makes sense. You know, I mean, I don't know what Plato and Aristotle would fucking have to say about it, or Democritus would have to say about this kind of shit. But, you know, these alternative facts things, you know, I mean, Rome did this, Greece did this, Sparta did this, but the difference between Rome and Greece and Sparta and what have you is they were honest about it. You know, the United States, they have the Orwell propensity and ability to totally wipe out what the fuck is real and convince us, you know, for people who really are just too lazy intellectually to fucking, you know, think, because I just don't accept the fact that, well, not the fact, but the idea that, you know, people are just stupid because. I just don't. I never have. Until something changes, I'm not likely to. But, you know, on the whole, it's really, you know, odd to me on how so many folks who consider themselves to be black revolutionaries per se, right? You know, however the fuck that's being defined right now. I mean, when you have Jim Brown talking about give Trump a chance, what the fuck is that? You know, really, what the fuck is that? You know, what is the name? You know, one of these other fucking rappers. I mean, yeah, and Kanye West was up there. I mean, what the fuck? Is there any real discussion about that? Is there any real, you know, talk about that? And then here we have Colin Kaepernick, and we have Jesse Williams. They're out there using their celebrity status to actually bring light to what the fuck is happening out here, and they get condemned talking about, well, you know, they don't represent the black experience because they're really two red bones. One motherfucker went so far as to say that Colin Kaepernick wasn't even black. So, yeah, you take it at, you know, as it is. There's a whole lot of fucking confusion out here. And, as I said, you know, Lupe's going to run some audio. That's it. So stick around. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Yeah, this is hip hop, right?
Hey, this is Vagabond producer, writer, and director Machetero. You're listening to The Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Yo, let's move on and talk about something else. About Steve Harvey. And I'm going to get Mark, and then I'll get the others in. So, Mark, Steve Harvey went to Trump Tower and is taking a lot of backlash for meeting with the president-elect. What do you make of this controversy?
You know, I love Steve Harvey, and I have respect for Steve Harvey, and I think his intentions were accurate, or appropriate, rather. But my disagreement is the way in which he's being used by folk like Donald Trump. Again, his intention is just to have a seat at the table. But when you're at the table, you should have experts at the table. You should have people who can challenge the president at the table. I don't care if Steve's there, but if I'm Steve Harvey, I'm bringing Michelle Alexander. I'm bringing Cornel West. I'm bringing Imani Perry. I'm bringing Eddie Glaude. I'm bringing Michael Eric Dyson. I'm bringing some folk with me who can challenge the president and inform the conversation. Otherwise, you're just being
Bruce,
trumpeted
up there. Bruce, why are you saying, oh, my God?
Because let me real quick. Because all because they keep bringing up comedians and actors and athletes to represent black interests is demeaning, it's disrespectful, and it's condescending. Bring some people up there with some expertise, Donald Trump. Don't just bring up people to entertain.
So Bruce. you were at the meeting. You heard and saw everything.
I don't understand how anything I said would prompt that question.
Listen.
Unless Steve Harvey turned into a policy analyst in the behind-the-scenes meeting, then it doesn't matter what I was there. I'm saying
Mark,
my concern
is
who the people he's trumpeting up and putting in front of the cameras.
Mark, you weren't even there. You don't even know what happened, okay?
Yes, I do. Are you disagreeing that you weren't in the room, sir. How does that negate my point that he brought Steve Harvey and then put him in front of the cameras?
Let me tell you, that's my critique.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Directly, I've lost a few friends.
How I've been affected by gun violence over the years is through deaths of friends and family members and associates.
When I was 5 years old, I was held at gunpoint in a home invasion.
I've gone to the juvenile detention centers and I've met dozens of young kids, babies really, who have been affected by gun violence. Directly, I've lost a few friends, but I think what why this touches my heart is having children of my own.
You know, I've been at parties where, you know, I had just left the party and, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I heard that, you know, somebody got shot and didn't make it.
There are a lot of people benefiting off of our pain, and it's time we do something.
I'm here to unload my investment because I think that it's important that we start kind of seeing where our money is going.
It's time to go to your financial advisor and demand that there are no gun investments in your 401k.
Even if you don't have investments, you can still help spread the word.
This is something everyone can do.
So if you push your people to have 401ks, it might be your grandma, it might be your cousin, this effort can make a big impact.
I'm unloading for my loved ones that I lost.
I'm unloading for my 18-year-old self.
I'm unloading my 401k for the future of my children.
I'm unloading.
I'm unloading
for my family and their future.
I'm unloading so that my daughter can grow up in a safe, loving world.
Unload and join the movement.
Use hashtag I'm unloading to pledge your support for gun-free investing.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs,
in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Star.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel,
all under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While world powers fund and support Israel, we,
the people of the world in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights.
If I boycott Israeli goods,
If I boycott Israeli goods,
it's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism. Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of their land. I reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew. Simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
There is only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all
and those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
And I don't know the name of this song, but it's dedicated to all my skin and friends. And it's called Skinny! When the skinhead walks down the street, every chick heart skips a beat. When the skinhead walks down the street, every chick heart skips a beat. Skinhead!
to hit it from the top. Cause this song is gonna make everybody rock. One, two, three, four.
Hi, this is Annie from Avoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio. A nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Asada, terrorist or survivor of terrorism. With the news of the posting of an additional $850,000 for the return of former Black Panther and Black Liberation Army member Assata Shakur from Cuba, the U.S. government has taken another step in its ridiculous so-called war on terrorism. They did this by New Jersey officials branding Assata with the latest libelous label, terrorist, in an attempt to justify this modern-day slave bounty. If anybody knows about terrorism, it's Americans, for this nation was founded in terrorism. So deep is this truth that it lies in the subconscious of almost every American and can be unleashed with unnerving ease. Come on, complete this phrase. The only good Indian is a blank. Black, white, rich, or poor, that phrase echoes in American consciousness, an inheritance from a time when those dark thoughts were dark realities of, yes, genocide against the native peoples that fed and healed the starving settlers from Europe who survived the Atlantic crossings. Terrorism, white terrible violence against red life and black life and brown life and yellow life. That is America's truest hidden history, hidden beneath lies about all men are created equal. In 1973, when Assata Shakur and Zaid Malik Shakur and Sundiata Akoli were stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike, they weren't stopped because the cops wanted to render assistance. This was a car stop for the unwritten crime of driving while black before we developed the term, and the cops tried to kill every Black Panther in that car for this unwritten crime. Zaid was shot to death, and Asada was shot twice, and in an act of arrogance that only American judicial terrorists can devise, she was charged with murdering both Zaid and the cop that tried to kill her. Asada went through a devil's brew of show trials in several states, best summed up in a book by her lawyer aunt, Evelyn Williams, titled Inadmissible Evidence. These were trials that seemed more fitting for Mississippi than Middlesex County, New Jersey, or Manhattan Borough, New York. But no matter where that happened, they featured all-white juries and ambitious judges who didn't even pretend to be fair and unbiased arbiters. Even despite these obvious obstructions, she was acquitted. And when she was convicted in Middlesex, it was clear this was a verdict not of her guilt, but of her political ideas. To label this woman a terrorist is to bleed all meaning from the word. For during her life as an activist, during her wounding at her arrest, and during her travails as an accused in courtrooms that were more lynching posts than halls of justice, she was terrorized by a system that wanted to punish her for daring to rebel. These words are written on May 13th, 2005, 20 years to the day from the police mass murder and bombing of the Move Home in Philadelphia. Today, 20 years later, only one person, Ramona Africa, ever spent a day in jail. What of those cops who shot and bombed unarmed children? What of the politicians who unleashed these dogs of urban war? Like Ramona, Asada was jailed for daring to survive. Cuba's valiant Fidel Castro responded almost immediately to announce his refusal to recognize this modern-day slave bounty. He pronounced her a political prisoner during her time in American gulags, perhaps remembering that she was held in an all-male jail during her incarceration. For centuries, nothing has so stirred up American fury like the escape of a slave. That ain't just distant history. For daring to slip her bonds and escape from brutal and unjust bondage, the empire now labels her a terrorist. That's because to them, nothing is more terrifying than resistance to their imperial will. As for terrorists, if they really want to find some, it shouldn't be too hard to find them. Just check the White House. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Sinclair Skinner. You can find me at SinclairSkinner.com. Twitter at Skinner Liberated. That's Skinner, LIBER, the number 8ED. And you found me on Aboriginal Radio.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
But a lot of folks don't know that the Black Panther Party had a position in solidarity with the Palestinians in 1968. We had wrote a position in the Panther newspaper, and the headline was Zionism plus racism equals genocide. And it was in full support of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. It presented an analysis of the occupied territories, how they became occupied. And we had sent a delegation to Beirut. We had working relationships with the PFLP under Dr. George Habash. We had a working relationship with the PLO. And and of course, this led to FBI and CIA machinations, by the way. They launched a whole campaign that was designed to divide the Black Panther Party from its, quote, liberal Jewish support. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the details of the counterintelligence program. Well, you know, I have over 600,000 pages or something like that, some crazy figures of COINTELPRO documents. And one of the things that stands out in these documents, that runs through this whole counterintelligence and domestic surveillance in the United States, is the fear that the establishment has of liberal Jews supporting civil rights. This is something that Jay Rubin was obsessed with in terms of Dr. King, in terms of civil rights movement. He became completely insane when it came to the Black Panther Party around this type of support. And one of the programs that the government launched was a program called it was a disinformation program, but they had a very racist name for it. And it involved the support of Jewish liberals for the Black Panther Party. And one of the outstanding examples, of course, was the Leonard Bernstein incident. I'm quite sure many of you who have read the COINTELPRO papers, who have read things around suppression of the Black movement, they were very, very keen on separating Black activism from white liberal support. And they saw Jewish liberals as being especially sympathetic, given the history of Jewish people in Europe, given the history of anti-Semitism in the United States and in Western societies. Of course, we know that many of the early activists in American working class history were Jews, were Jewish organizers, Jewish activists. We know that the greatest opposition to the rise of fascism and Nazism in Germany and in Europe were from Jews. Of course, there's a flip side to that. I don't want to get into that right now, but I'm trying to say that the federal government understood this, and they carried out a program to acerbate this particular contradiction. And this program involved forging letters sent to prominent Jewish philanthropists saying that the Black Panther Party were anti-Semitic, we supported Nazism, we were fat black fascists, that the Black Panther Party was racist, and it was anti-Israeli, and all of these things. And this was designed to cut off support for the Black Panther Party, and of course, this all came to light when I got my counterintelligence files from my lawsuit, and the Bernstein case was prominent in these documents. Leonard Bernstein, some of you may be too young to remember this, some of you, I think quite a few of you are old enough to remember, was an internationally renowned composer and leader of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, I believe. And he was a very prominent fellow in Western culture. And you know that the leader of this particular orchestra is very well known. And he hosted, in 1969, he hosted a dinner, a fundraiser for the Black Panther Party, the New York 21. And the FBI used this fundraiser, first of all, to underwrite and support and encourage the writings of what's this gentleman's name? The guy who dresses law, Dapper. I can't remember these characters, man. But they're all enshrined. I'm 65 years old, so they're all enshrined now. They're street names. And, you know, so here I walk by the names of streets named after my tormentors, you know. And now they have statues of them in the park, pigeon poop on it, and all of this stuff. But this guy wrote this book,
Bonfire of Vanities.
Yeah, Bonfire of Vanities, and the other one,
Radical
Chic was the article in the New York Magazine. He wrote Radical Chic, and this was supposed to, and you know, the FBI was ecstatic with this article. If you read the reports about, they were ecstatic that this guy wrote this article, because they felt it was a very effective propaganda piece for liberal Jews who did. It's a wake-up call, you know, these guys are thugs, they're murderers, they're killers, and all of these things. And I undoubtedly probably did have some thug murders and killers somewhere in the Black Panther Party. I mean, you got thug murders and killers in the U.S. government. So I'm quite sure Obama can't account for any thug murder and killer in the U.S. government. So we couldn't account for everyone that might have been in the Black Panther Party. But he wrote this book, and the whole idea was to scare Jewish support. And now we're witnessing the same thing now with Islamophobia. Yes. We're looking at the same thing now. You know, I wrote a paper that was to be delivered. I think I sent it to you, didn't I? I had wrote a outline, because, you know, our Palestinian comrades and a lot of folks who are not who have immigrated to the United States are not really familiar with the repressive history of the United States, which is one of the reasons why perhaps the late Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, is such a valuable tome, because it opened up the eyes of a lot of folks, you know, to what America, its real history is about, you know, the ability of counterintelligence programs to force a wedge between white left liberal support of a radical black nationalist organization was a historical lesson that we should really learn. You know, I know from talking to folks here that there's cases right now pending in the court and grand juries right here in Minneapolis. And the grand jury, of course, is being used as an instrument for political repression. It's used as an instrument to probe into organizations. It's used as an instrument of coercion and intimidation. And this has been the history of the grand jury since the 50s, since the McCarthy era. So we're not looking at really anything new when we're looking at this Patriot Act. And this is my point, because a lot of us think that this Patriot Act represents something that's new. Yes, new. It's a new and improved version, because of course we're living in a different time. You know, where this is not the McCarthy era. You know, Muslims are not quote communists. Okay, this is not pre World War I, pre World War II, or even immediate post World War II. This is the 21st century. This is at a point in history where U.S. democracy has developed into a form of democratic fascism. And this may seem as a contradiction in terms. I mean, a lot of us who have come up in the left and have used these terms, communists and socialists and fascists, we all have these strict definitions of what a fascism is, and what communism is, and what socialism is, and what capitalism is. But what we fail to realize is that the United States is a unique form of empire that has evolved out of its own history. There is no other historical development of a nation state that compares to the United States. I mean, just think about it. Let's go back and revisit, each of you, if you will, Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Just go back and revisit it for a minute. And you'll see that the development of the U.S. as a republic, as a political entity, as a cultural entity, has occurred inside of a historical moment that is unlike any historical moment that's ever occurred in modern civilization. France didn't have this. We know the development of France from the Frankish clans, and we know the development of England from the Angles and the Saxons and the Teutons. All of these particular historical developments we know about. We know about the legacy of Rome in Europe, but what do we know about the development of the United States as an entity, as an embassy, that brought forward Western civilization to where it's at today? What do we know about? You go out into the street here in Minneapolis, and this is a college town in many respects, and ask the average kid on the street, you know, to locate three countries. Just say Cambodia, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Just ask them to locate where are these countries at, you know, what's the population, just in general. And you'll find, you'll be surprised at the answers. There's this abysmal amount of ignorance that passes for education in the school system. And this is important to understand because the United States is first and foremost an empire in denial. The denial part is only possible with miseducation of the population. So we actually have people sit on television and debate whether the United States is an empire or not. I mean, that's a given. What is there to talk about? You see? I mean, what is there to talk about? And if we look at how the issues are framed, whether they're the issues of human rights, whether they're the issues of environment, whether they're the issues of technology, whether they're the issues of immigration, look at these issues in their context, in their historical context, and you would see that there is a direct evolutionary chain of events from, I would venture to say, and I'm just cutting it off here for convenience sake, from 1945, from the end of World War II, up until this moment. Everything that we're going through right now in this moment in this country is a consequence of the end of that conflict. That's what it's about. Now, there's other issues in which we all know that particular conflict, the basis for that was set in the First World War. I'm just cutting it off in 1945 because we can't get too ancient with a lot of young folks here. Because it's like, hey man, that's like ancient history. Wasn't that when Caesar was around or something? You know, and so you can't do that with young folks. So we have some young folks here. We gotta try to keep it jiggy. Try to keep the flow going. So we're going to cut it off in 1945 when I was 1 year old. So if I'm standing here, it can't be that ancient. Okay? So we're going to cut it off there. But the reason why I want to say that is because when we look at the roots of the conflict in the Middle East, it's from there. It's from World War I. It's from the Balfour Agreement. It's from the occupation of Palestinian territory. It's from the whole phenomenon of empires at the end of the century in Europe, the Bolshevik Revolution and in Russia. I mean, we do know. And these are facts. And this is something that is very difficult to really get across to progressive people who feel uncomfortable about Zionism. And that is that the state of Israel and the whole context, the geopolitical context that we call the Middle East, which is something else they don't talk about, that the state of Israel is a European settler state. It's a European settler state. Pure and simple. Whatever ideology it uses to justify that, whatever nationalism it uses to justify that, does not take away that dialectic and that dynamic. It's a European settler state. Now, if it's a European settler state, you know, we know that settler states have certain things, certain characteristics about them. And all these characteristics fit the profile of the Zionist state of Israel. It's racist and apartheid. Its elites come from outside of the territory, have no connection whatsoever to the land. It has it's an expansionist in nature. It's reactionary in its international and diplomatic politics. It allies itself with some of the most reactionary forces on the planet. We got to remember that Israel had an alliance with South Africa, apartheid South Africa. And was conducting nuclear tests with South Africa. There's many of us in here remember all of this. A lot of young folks don't know this, but there's plenty of us in here I can see who remember all of this, who remember during the anti-apartheid struggle and how we had to boycott the Israeli embassies and get them to withdraw their support from South Africa. What was the U.S. position on South Africa then? Constructive engagement. Remember? The U.S. position was, well, we can't boycott South Africa because we're going to hurt the people. What we have to do is constructively engage the government to change the policies against the black majority. Constructive engagement. That was the policy of the United States government. Constructive engagement. And what is the policy now towards the Middle East? Constructive engagement. It's the same policy. They talk about a peace process, the quartet. I mean, do you think people over there singing or something? You know, are they singing doo-wops? old style tunes? Or are we listening to the Flamingos and, you know, and stuff like that? Or are they all singing, what's that guy from AC/DC? You know, that crew, you know, the guy with the double stuff on, you know. I mean, what's the quartet? Absolutely. I mean, the American public is absolutely confused. Just look at this. Just, I mean, we look at the economy. I mean, now the economy belongs to Obama. But how many of us watched the moment that Obama was about to ascend to the presidency, Bush comes out and declares that the country's bankrupt? The same month. And then the Republicans, in less than 2 weeks, are claiming on how Obama is the one who brought the economy. I mean, this. I mean, we just go from one absurdity to the next, which tells you that the empire is in trouble. It's in trouble. Whenever a nation state, a republic, a system that relied on white supremacy through its entire history, through changing the complexion, the characteristics of white supremacy, for over 200 years, elects a black man as president, that should tell you something. Now, of course, it told some black folks that meant that America has reached the point where race no longer matters. I mean, we don't even have to argue that on an emotional basis. We just could argue that on a factual basis, because every statistic that shows the social, economic, and political well-being of ethnic groups in the United States is fraught with the overemphasis of negativity on black folks. I mean, when we look at employment, if it's 10%, 12% in the white community, it's like 37% in the black community. And you got to remember, when they talk about double the unemployment rate, they're only talking about people who apply for unemployment. You know, you got black folks in the black community who stopped looking for jobs 5 or 6 years ago. You know, they're in the other economy. You know that other economy that we transact business with, you know, that multi-billion-dollar year economy is off the books, okay? So when we look at this country, we know that race is not something that's behind us. So how do we explain a black president? How do we explain people in middle America who may have had misconceptions about people of African ancestry voting for Barack Obama? And I'm quite sure if any of you have read anything that I've written on this subject in the past, you know what the answer is. Barack Obama is not an African American. I mean, he's an African that was born in an American state, Hawaii. But actually, Barack Obama has more in common with most folks in this room than he has with me. You know, and this could be seen in a question that was put to Barack Obama by one of these right-wing journalists. And they said, you know, you're being accused of being, because you're black, that you have black agenda, you know. This was after the Wright issue, during the Wright, you know, Reverend Wright, Bruja. And he was asked, well, do you still support Reverend Wright in his extreme statements? He said, I can no more deny Reverend Wright than I could, you know, deny the black community. But I'm not limited by being black. That's what he said. He said the opposite. He didn't say, I have a white mother, I was raised in a white family, in a white community, I went to a predominantly white school, I had a predominantly white education, you know, but I'm not, you know, defined by that. I'm not confined to that. He didn't say that. He said the opposite. He was appealing to the white folks in America, saying, look, you don't have to worry about me waking up in the morning with a flashback to the plantation, because I was never on the plantation. You know, I'm not going to get a flashback and call, you know, the 1st Air Force in to firebomb Alabama or the capital of Mississippi, you know, that has to smile up a Confederate flag, because I don't have that in my DNA. And he doesn't have that. Michelle has it, but we didn't vote for Michelle. My point is, white America didn't vote for an African American. They didn't vote for someone that had the history and the legacy of being underclass and second-class citizens in a country for generations. His family did not come from the plantation. They were not descendants of slaves. In fact, his father was a colonial. Okay? So my point is that white folks don't even consider the obvious. This guy got more in common with y'all than he does with us. I mean, after all, he was raised by a white family. All of y'all were raised by white families. I wasn't raised by a white family. He got more in common with you. I mean, this is just basic logic. But this is a logic that flies in the face of the historical movement. And the historical movement is basically this. That since 1945, the United States has been, and now it is, the supreme military and political power on the planet. And it has manipulated every international institution to support its policies and its initiatives and its strategic interests. We know from the founding of the United Nations, we know why the United Nations was founded, despite all of the glorious rhetoric about wars being, you know, more humane and no more war. The United Nations, for the first 10 years of its existence, carried out what? U.S. foreign policy. Korea, South Vietnam, Indonesia, Eastern Europe, every interest that the United States had, the UN intervened in its behalf. The Security Council, the most undemocratic institution on the planet, is dominated by the former imperialist power, which tells you that globalization is nothing but New Age imperialism. It's a new form of imperialism because it's built upon the old structures and institutions that came out of World War II, which were decidedly imperialist. What was the first objective of the victors of World War II? To recoup the territories of their former imperial glory. The French wanted Indochina back, couldn't get it. Of course, you know, forget the Italians. They bugged out in the middle of the war, so they definitely wasn't getting anything back. You know, the British wanted to reconstitute its empire, went through a whole big thing with India, recognizing, you know, I mean, this whole history. And the reason why I'm throwing out all these historical things is for you to understand that all of these things have come to this moment in time. All of these forces have come to this point in time. They talk about the clash of civilizations between Islam and the West, and then you have one group of Muslims over here telling you that Islam is a religion of peace, we share the same ancestors, which is a lie. It's not true, by the way. But without getting into the theological basis of it, we share the same ancestors in terms of Abraham, which the Muslims call Ibrahim. We share the same ancestors, blah, 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 blah. You know, and therefore, Muslims should be someone that you should fear. They're just like you. They get up in the morning. They want the best for their children. Like Muslims came from another planet. You know, they came from the planet Mongo. And we don't want what's good for us. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like when white folks used to say, you people. You people? Yeah, what do you people want? Yeah, I see that all the time. You know? And the person that was saying was not necessarily a mean-spirited person or someone that was really just an out-and-out, you know, racist. In their ignorance, they saw themselves as separate from you. And this is what we're looking at now when we look at Palestine, when we look at the Palestinian region. We look at what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Iraq, and what's happening in Afghanistan as separate from us in certain respects. I mean, we're concerned with the mortgage, right? We're concerned with paying our bills. We're concerned with getting our children a decent education. We're concerned with, you know, being able to walk the street safely in the evening. We're concerned with jobs. We're concerned with our environment. We're concerned with all these issues, but all of these issues are directly connected to what's happening in Palestine. How is it? Give you just a simple example. The United States government subsidizes the Israeli economy to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a month. Not a day, not a year, a month. Hundreds of millions. This is non-military aid. Huh? Non-military. But yet and still, that same government is cutting back in development of schools in our communities. They don't have the money for schools. They don't have the money to improve our infrastructure. They don't have the money to move technology into the ghetto. I mean, we're in a digital divide right in every urban area that we live in. On one side of the tracks where white folks live with money, there's fiber optics, there's internet cafes, and there's wireless you know, spaces, and in the side where the black community is, people are still using dial-up. Black folks are still using dial-up. Do you remember dial-up? Anybody remember dial-up? Sitting there going to get dinner while the computer loads? Okay, let me go get a drink. You know, that's, we're still on dial-up. They done moved to files and fiber optics and all of this stuff, right? So there's a digital divide. In terms of environmental racism, we see where that's at. We see that this whole issue in Somalia, I mean, we could get into that, you know, the West, East Coast of Africa. No one has talked about toxic dumping and all of these things that the Western nations have been doing in the Third World and in Africa until people in the Third World start hijacking the ships. When they start hijacking the ships, then you see takedown of pirates in the Somalia. You know, and they talk about how, you know, special forces have been training for this moment in time, and they rescued the crew from this hijack. You know, some big hero story. It's going to be a movie with Arnold or somebody. Arnold's not acting no more. It's going to be a movie with one of them guys. It's probably going to be the next governor of California. And so I'm saying that there is a direct connection with our government spending money on wars. Spending money on building infrastructures abroad that it cannot sustain and build at home. I mean, we have a population in the United States that's opposed to universal health care. I mean, how dumb can you get? You really got to be stupid to go for that one. I'm telling you, you're better off with insurance. Trust you? The insurance company? Weren't you the guys that just got us into this mess? Trust AIG? We should trust AIG? Huh? Should we? We should trust Prudential? Trust me? So now the guys said, well, you know, I mean, yeah, I don't know if y'all saw the special on TV, but yeah, this guy actually sit up and said that it was un-American for him to not be able to choose who his health provider. It was un-American. He was a capitalist. He felt that, and then they asked him, are you working now? He says, well, I'm not working now, which is true. And if I don't get a job within the next 90 days, I don't know what I'm doing. I have this condition, some type of physical condition, and they won't give me treatment for it. And here's a guy that's explaining to us, in one breath, how he's about to die because he doesn't have health insurance and a job, and then the other breath told him that that's his right to die that way as an American. I think the homeboy is scrambled up. Where is this problem? And you have to understand that if you sat down in a room with the average person that believes socialism is something negative and actually sat down with them and asked them, what is socialism doing? You would be shocked by what they would say. We know that the Russians gave socialism a good idea, a bad name. We know that. Okay, they gave a good idea, a bad name. You got to admit that. Okay, Stalin, Khrushchev, you know. People, you know, society taking care of the ill, taking care of the elderly, you know, providing reason. All these principles of socialism are good ideas. It's just these knuckleheads gave it a bad rep. So now you have people in the United States saying that Obama's a socialist. I mean, Obama's a socialist. Oh, you wish, right? You know, he's a socialist. I mean, anytime somebody... How did anybody say that? I mean, here's a man that was groomed, and this was my point. He was groomed for this historical moment. I don't think anybody in the world would have listened to another George Bush lookalike. After nobody in the world since 1945 to now, we have had white men, mainly white men, tell the world what was best. We have had men, white, black, Arab, and everybody, creating wars, waging wars for empire, for power, for territory, and all of these things. But the United States has come forward now with a black man as president at the point in time when the empire is in dire straits. Because no one else can sit in the empire. Don't think that Obama is not doing his job. He is doing an excellent job. It's just not for us. He is doing the job that he was groomed four, and he's doing a wonderful job. And y'all should give him a round of applause for doing this job. Because the job that he is doing is saving the empire from itself. Because despite U.S. policies, and you all know here that his policies internationally has not deviated one iota from the Bush administration. Not one. Just in terms of rhetoric and game it has. But it's the same old policy. Whether it's in relationship to Iran, whether it's in relationship to Palestine and the Middle East, whether it's in relationship to... The only thing that he's almost different from is the issue, certain domestic issues like health. He's the only president that brought this far. And I mean, and all of us can agree that it's just about washed up. The type of health care programs that we thought he would bring into existence is not happening. You know? And but he's tried in that respect. Okay? But that's about it. So the empire is in dire straits. And the world economy, the U.S. use of the military, the U.S. cannot maintain 2 and 3 wars with a volunteer army. So what does it do? Privatize war. Do you know we have over 180,000 private contractors working abroad in behalf of the U.S. military? In Iraq alone, when they count the casualty figures and they count the number of personnel that's on the ground, they do not count contractors. Okay? So privatization of the military and privatization of what at home go hand in hand. Criminal law enforcement. Privatization of prisons. The use of corporations to carry out functions of the state that used to be functions of the state. We've seen this beginning with Katrina. We've seen this with Blackwater in New Orleans when the police abandoned the people. And we'll see it again as catastrophes arise. The major contractors in building prisons abroad is Brown and Root. They build everything. They build military bases. They build prisons. They build facilities for airport facilities. They build harbor facilities. This is one company, Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton. And I think, so your homeboy, one of your vice presidents, used to be involved. What's his name?
Cheney.
Yeah, that guy. That guy. So I'm saying that there is a direct connection between the economy of empire and domestic and foreign policy. It's a direct connection. It's nothing indirect. When we look at the repression that's being carried out against Muslims here, against philanthropic organizations, Islamic organizations who are doing charity work. Here in the United States, they've had the property seized. Their members are indicted and arrested. But at the same time the United States is doing this to philanthropic organizations, it is militarized foreign aid abroad. There's no distinction between the State Department's USAID program in Afghanistan and the Defense Department's development program. In fact, the Defense Department controls, from what I've read, over 65% of the foreign aid budget. The Defense Department. So foreign aid workers are seen now as adjuncts of the military. So they're no longer neutral, they're no longer safe, they can be no longer trusted. And it's the same thing in our community. What is happening in our community? All of our politicians, all of our political leaders, and I don't really have any here. We do that. You, my friend? So all of our politicians and most of our political leaders don't represent their constituency. They don't represent their community. They represent the corporate interest that finances their campaigns and that makes their candidacy possible. This is where the money comes from. This is where the influence comes from. And when we look at the black community, especially like in the Northeast, we see the inordinate influence of Zionist organizations and Zionist institutions in supporting our own political leaders. So now we have a point, we have come to the point, where if we go over the record of the black congressional caucus, if we go over their voting record on the issue of Palestine, whenever they have an opportunity to vote on that issue, on international issues in the Middle East, they have consistently voted in behalf of Israel and in behalf of AIPAC and the Zionist lobby. They have never opposed. Only few congresspersons have opposed them, and most of them wound up like Cynthia McKinney. Yeah. So what do we have here? We have in this country a false sense of democracy. We have democratic fascism in this country when you actually think about it, because fascism is the what? The marriage of the corporate state, the marriage of the corporations and the economy of the elite with the state. And if you can't get more married than the corporate state in America, the corporations and the states are like this. We have black politicians right here in our country who are fervent advocates for the state of Israel, and they won't advocate for one black political prisoner in this country. They won't advocate for one grand jury resistor in this country. If you walked up to them and say, look, what's your position on Umar Abu-Jamal, they'll run straight across the room. And they might tell you to your face, but we support the brother, and so and so and so. But would they put a resolution on that floor for Umar? Hell no. And the reason why is because they're not really opposed to the death penalty. And Umar has become the international symbol in opposition to the death penalty. He has become a symbol. I mean, I travel to the Middle East and travel to Turkey and travel all over Africa. And they asked me, what's happening with Umar Abu-Jamal? But you haven't got a black politician in the United States to sit up in the Senate and say one mumbling word about the death penalty in Umar Abu-Jamal.
Thank you.
Not one. You have the imam of a large community in the United States sitting up in Colorado in prison, locked down 23 hours a day for the murder of a police officer that was patently assaulted. There's absolutely no evidence on it. He doesn't even have a federal conviction, but he's in a federal penitentiary. He's in the United States domestic version of Guantanamo, right there in Colorado. And that's Imam Jamil Al-Amin. Many of us know him as H. Mack Brown. The recent murder of Imam Lukman, who was a follower of Imam Al-Amin in Detroit. I know many of you heard about that murder of this Imam in Detroit. What was the strategy of the United States government and the FBI when they murdered this man? This man was shot over 21 times. What was their strategy? The strategy was the exact same strategy they used against the Black Panther Party. Do you remember the murder of Fred Hampton?
Yes.
When they murdered Fred Hampton, what did they say? They went to serve a legal warrant on these crazy Panthers, and they started shooting at him through the door. And they returned the fire, and they killed this man. Okay? Of course, back then, they didn't have major case squad, you know, crime scene, CSI, and all of that stuff to run up and, you know, wrap the yellow tape around the crime scene and put the bodies up, outline the chalk right away. So the Panthers went into the building and opened it up to the press and the public immediately after the assault. And the people came and saw that all the bullets were going into the house. None of them were coming out. So it belied the story of the FBI. They had to backstep. And say, well, you know, it wasn't like that. They started lying. And to this day, the family has never gotten justice. But the point is this, that the people that set up Fred Hampton was an FBI before. The plans were given to the state. The state then took the plans and raided the house and murdered Fred Hampton in his sleep after he was drugged. But you know, the autopsy showed that he was drugged. Okay? They murdered him in his sleep. And they said that basically, you know, well, we can murder Black Panther because, you know, they're crazy and they're about guns and they don't like cops. And so it's okay to murder them. That's basically what was being said. And that's the exact same thing that was being said about Jamal Lukman. They fabricated some story about how he was advocating for the establishment of an Islamic state in America. Come on, man. That's what they say on NFL Today. Come on, man. I mean, there's not a Muslim in America. There's not a sane Muslim in America who is talking about an Islamic state of North America. That's not happening. Okay? That's like a non-starter. So where did the press come up with this? They said, well, his followers talked about belonging to the Ummah. every Muslim on the planet belongs to the Ummah. You see, the point here is that the reason why this man was murdered is because he represented a segment of Islam in this country is violently opposed to and afraid of. And that is the 35% of this population who are African American. Because the history of African America, of Africans in America, is a history of racist repression, is a history of genocide, is a history of murder, is a history of injustice. And so they fear black folks. I mean, look at all of the FBI documents throughout, from COINTELPRO up until now. What do they talk about? Homegrown terrorists, indigenous revolutionaries. Black folks are like the house version of Osama bin Laden. We're like the in-house version. You know, we might rise up and get down with any revolutionary rhetoric or any revolutionary program that talks about offering white folks. So we just like knuckleheads sitting around waiting for a plan from somebody. Okay? We don't have a mind of our own, a history of our own, a history of struggle of our own. We have a history of struggle in this country. And that history of struggle is not just marching for voting rights. It's not just trying to get on the ballot. That history of struggle has changed the face of this nation. When most left organizations were homophobic or hating on gay people, it was the Black Panther Party that put out a resolution talking about gay rights and homosexual rights in this country. The Black Panther Party. That's right, really. Really. Go look at it on this Black Panther Party. And this was in 1968. 1968, when they were talking about the war in Vietnam, it was the Black Panther Party who broke down the analysis of U.S. imperialism and supported the French and everything and said that we would send volunteers to fight on the side of the LLF. It was the Black Panther Party. When our children were going to school and weren't being fed and couldn't get no meals in the school, it was the Black Panther Party that started the breakfast program and started feeding children. Today, in school, lunch programs is normal. Everybody gets to eat. In fact, the state gives subsidies to families so that they can feed their children. There's a whole bureaucracy based upon that. Now, when you look at Black History Month, when you go into the month of October in every school in this country, see if you find one historical mention that the Black Panther Party started food programs in school. They got the day that Peanuts became a cartoon. Hey, my son's program celebrates great days in history. Peanuts was the first, was a cartoon on this day in 1931. Do they have on this day in October the Black Panther Party founded the breakfast program? Huh? And you know why they don't? Because of the black folks who are administering the school. That's why. The school I'm talking about is a black school. The administrators are black. They're young African-American administrators, teachers, and whatever. And what's on the Board of Education holidays to celebrate? Everything that's white. Everything that has nothing to do with... Oh, of course, it's Louis Armstrong's birthday. He played the trumpet. Can't get past Martin. He was a dreamer. Can't get past Obama. He raised the most money any black man raised for a campaign. All that stuff is in there. But is there one mention of that? Is there one resolution by city council? Councilman placed on that. And here you got folks in the Congress, like Bobby Rush, who were members of the Black Panther Party. And if you was to walk up to Bobby Rush today and say, I know him personally, I'd say, Bobby, you know, we need some help around this issue with the media. You know what you're telling me? My plate is full, brother. I can't really deal with that. That's a good job. So why should I talk to somebody like a Bobby Rush? What's the point? So, my point here is that in America, we have come to the point where democracy is an oxymoron. It's a useless term. It can mean anything and it means absolutely nothing. You do not have a system where we can develop a third party or even a loyal opposition. It's not like Europe. You know, in Europe, when one party wins, it usually has to win by a certain percentage of the votes. And if it doesn't win by that percentage of the votes, it has to form a coalition with the opposition. And so in Europe, you have communist parties and leftist parties who are used to sharing power, who have been involved in the power process, who may have set up shadow governments, so that when the media tells a story, it has to go to the opposition to get this out. That's not happening here in America. In America, it's winner take all. winner take all. So if 45 or 55 or 60% of the population vote, and 90% of or 50 or 40 or 60% of that population votes for one candidate, the other 40% forget about it. You ain't got no, you know, unless homeboys to get power decide to put you on the, or in the cabinet, or put you on there, you know, give you a job. Otherwise, forget about it. So you have a situation in this country where direct vote is not happening. And we know this from the disenfranchisement of millions of African Americans during the last two campaigns. Black folks was disenfranchised. And how many black politicians pressed the issue? How many of them filed a lawsuit? There was only a certain group of black politicians that pressed that issue until they became totally irrelevant. It was like, oh man, who are these people? They're crazy. You know, it's all over. The Supreme Court appointed the president. You know, live with it. Let's move on. You see? So we've had these experiences. We've had these experiences where we have had third world banana republic elections in this country and everybody thought it was democracy. So what I'm trying to point out here is that what we really have to try to focus on now is how can we build those networks and those relationships that begin to empower people on a very basic level. And I think one of the key issues right now, of course, is the issue of political detainees. Because this goes to the heart of our civil and human rights. What they have done in Guantanamo, in the name of America, they have been doing to black people in prison in this country for years. There is not one technique. There is not one technique that they have started in Guantanamo that they didn't do to us. When I was in prison, it was common to go to the isolation units and have them turn up the heat in the summer and close the windows until you sweat and you have to walk around in your cell almost naked. And in the winter, they'll open the windows and turn the heat on. This is common. They do this in Unit 14 up in Clinton Prison. You don't have to go all the way to Guantanamo or read a report from a prison, from a Bagram Air Base to see that. Waterboarding? Do you know in New York State Prison, they used to hose you down in your cell and open up the windows in the winter so that you would freeze. This is nothing new. Forced haircuts, forced feeding, beatings. If you didn't know how to fight naked upstate New York, you didn't know how to fight because you had to fight buck naked. So where am I getting all of these things from? Am I making this all up in my mind? They just invented this when the war on terror started? No. They've been implementing this on African people in the United States since the first black man landed in this country. And you have black leaders that actually sit up on TV and get up in the Congress and talk about the policies of this government. The policies of this government were rational and didn't have a historical basis. This is something that Cheney and Bush just started. Nixon ain't had nothing to do with it. The major architect of rendition was not Bush and Cheney. It was the present representative of the United States to the United Nations, Miss Rice. That's who began the rendition process in East Africa. And as we speak right now, no matter what these crackers say in government, they are still running rendition camps in Kenya. They are still running rendition camps in Eastern Europe and in East Africa. They have surrogates like the Ethiopians, and they have surrogate powers like the Kenyans who are doing their dirty work for them. And we have black leaders. I mean, I've worked with refugees in Africa from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and from Congo. And the individuals who control these struggles, who are controlling blood diamonds, are the same ones that the black caucus, right here in this country, used to sit up and fet in Washington, D.C. The same individual talking about they were progressives in Africa when they were pieces of shit in Africa. So what I'm trying to say to you is that we have disingenuous and misleaders in the black community here who vote against our interests internationally and then turn around and talk to us about reform and urban agendas. There is a connection between U.S. domestic policy and U.S. foreign policy. Obama can talk about urban institutions being and urban infrastructures being renovated. That's one thing to talk about. But how do you reconcile renovating these institutions when all of the money that should go to renovate these institutions are supporting reactionary foreign policy? So we have to understand right here that what we're dealing with is increasingly as the empire begins to collapse, begins to become dysfunctional, that it's the networks that we create in our communities that will help us survive. We see that in Katrina. You know, before Katrina, I did a speaking tour in the United States. In fact, I was in the United States when Katrina happened, and I live in Africa. And the thing I was talking about then was the necessity for a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency. I said, you know, whenever we look at a tragedy or disaster in Africa, it's always white folks who are coming forth to tell us, you know, what's happening. It's, you know, Doctors Without Borders, you know, psychologists without hospitals, without couches. You know, all of these different, you know, and believe me, the work that these people are doing is very good work. A lot of them are doing invaluable work. I mean, I've been up into these places, man. You know, don't have access to medical care. And so, you know, I'm not making fun or ridiculing the intentions of the people who are involved in these types of programs. So I'm not ridiculing that. But the point is that African Americans, who control over $60 billion a year in disposable income, are absent. And this is the continent of the origin. They're absent, completely absent. When Haiti jumped off, where are we sending the money to? The Red Cross. No. Salvation Army. The State Department. We don't have no agency of our own. Forget the black community. The left, the progressive community, doesn't have no agency on this. Without these types of instruments, without these types of networks, what can we achieve? What can we accomplish? Not much. We are living in a country where winners take all. A third party is not possible. Or if a third party is possible, let me give you this caveat because I think this is happening now. If a third party is possible, it would be imagination from the right. And that's what we see happening with this Tea Party. If a third party evolves in the United States, it would be imagination from the right because you have the epitome of a white folk fit. A black man, a nigga with his finger on the trigger. So, I mean, although they created this man they created this political entity that we know as Barack Obama to get them through this particular crucial phase of the empire, don't think that they won't blame him if it doesn't work. It would be our fault. We were too concerned with race. Now, you know Obama hasn't mentioned race since he's been in office. And it's not a coincidence that most black politicians who are in Congress haven't mentioned race neither since he's been in office. It's like he got a pass, you see. So when we talk about this, we have to really understand that what we have developed in this country is, first of all, democratic fascism, which passes for democracy. We have racial politics in which now the keepers of the castle, the ones who have made a living off of race politics. You know, we have a whole bunch of race. We have had black leaders who made a living off of race politics. I mean, that's been their thing. They got paid that way. You know, this has been their sole claim to fame. This is how they got their living. And now that these individuals are being sort of like retired, semi-retired, you know, they have to fend for themselves. They have to develop programs and ideas and struggles. This is why you see Barack Obama can go to the NAACP and give a speech to black men about how they need to be more responsive. Check that out. He's going to lecture black folks how they should be more responsible for their children. You have black leaders going on television talking about violence in the black community and in the streets amongst our youth is basically their fault. They're the reason why, you know, there's violence in the community. They're the reasons why. We're not taking time to educate our children. We're not taking time to go and be hands-on in our community and take care of our children. all the mayhem in the world is not being caused by black kids. Why don't white folks educate their children? Why don't they take responsibility for their children? All the Columbines and all of these crazy murders and all these serial killers running around here, very few of them black. So we got some dysfunctional white families up in this piece too. How come you don't lecture white folks about how they need to be more responsible? See, he has more in common with them than he does with black folks. No, he doesn't do that because the onus for oppression is always put on the oppressed. The onus for being backwards is always put on the people who can't go forward. That's the onus. And that's not to say that we're not responsible for what we do. But information is intelligence, and in this day and age, there's more people that want to know less than there are people that want to know more. Because once you know something, you're responsible for what you know. You see? That's why you see that at the end of World War II, what did Eisenhower and the generals do to all those people that lived near the concentration camps? He walked them through the concentration camps to show them what was going on right next to them. And then what were they going to say? Oh, well, all the smoke that was coming up, foul. It did smell kind of funny. Well, we didn't know they were murdering people down the road. Ignorance was what? Bliss. Now what you don't know will get your ass killed. It's no longer bliss. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Iraq. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Palestine. You can't say you don't know what's happening in Somalia. You can't say that no more. You go on the internet, man, you get information overload. So you can't say that ignorance, that you don't know. What you're saying now is that you know and you don't care. What you know doesn't translate into action. And that's the disconnect. What we know, we are responsible for. If we know that something is wrong, we are responsible to right it. Now, some of us may not have the courage. Some of us may not have the physical capacity or whatever to get out into the street and demonstrate. Or they may not be that articulate to articulate a point, you know. But we all can do something. And we all can make a contribution to those who can do something. And I think that one of the first things that we have to really see is that it's our networks that will make a difference, that will protect us in catastrophe. We have to have readiness networks. We have to be able to have our own clinics in our community. The churches in our community should be repositories of survival programs. We should be able to store survival gear there. What would happen if tomorrow if all electricity went off in Minneapolis and never came back home? What would you do? Wait for Homeland Security? FEMA? Yeah, I remember folks still waiting for FEMA in New Orleans. What would you do? Seriously, what would you do? We don't know what we would do with the elderly in the projects. If somebody lives on the 16th floor, how would we get them downstairs? How would the old people get something to eat? How would we get them to some place, some shelters? What are we going to do with our youth? What are they going to do? The schools are closed. What are we going to do? Think about that. The lights go off and don't come back on. Just think about that. That's a scary thought. You have to rely on the fire department. The fire department to say, okay, these are good guys, man. And I give firemen their props because they go running. Anybody that runs into a fire to save another human being deserves my praise. You know, whatever their politics are. But they got families too. Don't think they're going to be so concerned about my family, they're not going to go look out for theirs. Where did the police go in New Orleans? They want to look out for their family. They can't, look, defend and protect? Yeah, right over here. You see? What did we have? Nothing. What are the Crips and the Bloods and all these gangbangers doing in our community? If anybody knew the history of these gangs, the sociological and political history of these gangs, you'd be shocked. These gangs didn't start out slinging drugs and thugging and living a thug life. They didn't start out that way. They were made into that by a system that refused to deal with what they were talking about. Remember when what was the sister's name from California? This was years ago. She was coming out and she was a congressperson, and she was burning CDs and rap DVDs. She was burning them, talking about rap music was negative, rap music was misogynist, rap music was the music of the devil, and all this other stuff. Now, when's the last time you seen people burning stuff? Last time I saw that was on a documentary on the military channel, and it was showing how the Nazis was burning books. That was a prelude to what? To what we know as one of the most difficult times in human history. But this woman was out there burning all of these discs and all of these. Now look at hip-hop. Now look at gangster rap. Now look at misogyny. Did it diminish because of her actions? Did she and the black politicians who were so negative about rap music, did that change the lucrative nature of the culture? Did that change it?
No.
No. What happened to certain forces who were not necessarily sympathetic to the community that these artists came from took that music, glamorized it, publicized it, produced it, distributed it, made sure it got rotation on the radio, so every 5 minutes you hear somebody holding their groin or their crotch talking about hold this and hold that. Homegirl's CD burning didn't work. But it was good for politics. It was good for her. It was good for the Negro politicians who didn't have anything else better to do. They weren't out there burning. They weren't out there burning their card, their donation card to AIPAC. They weren't burning that. You see, instead of engaging those black youth and moving that away from that paradigm of corporate control and negativity, they condemned it and moved it right into the camp. So now, all of those guys that were talking all of that slick cop killer stuff, they all play cops on the television. They're all cops. All cops. If they're not cops, they're the leader of some gang of mutants, you understand, who eat human flesh or something. But they all play cops. Ice tea, Ice Cube, Iceberg, they all play cops. So, what I'm getting at is, we have had, over the years, black leaders who have come forward, seemingly on a progressive note, who are in fact reactionary, and who are in fact leading the way for reactionary control of our community. And now in our community today, we still don't control anything. We've had, in Harlem, for instance, we've had the Harlem Chamber of Commerce, Charlie Rangel, and all of these Negroes get together in Harlem and talk about how, we have to open up Harlem to gentrification, and we open it up to businesses, and now we got Body Shop, we got all of the major corporations on 125th Street, all of the little small entrepreneurs, the guys was out there selling t-shirts and all that stuff, they're gone. Body Shop and all of them are there. The real estate values have gone up. And now there's no black person in Harlem that can afford an apartment no more. You have all of these boutiques in Harlem selling upscale stuff that you find down in Soho, and nobody in Harlem is buying that. Where's their clientele at? And this is the result of the Charlie Rangels in our leadership. Yeah, you can tell that to Charlie when you see him again. It's the result of these Negroes. They're the ones that led us down this path of prosperity. Okay? So what I'm saying to you, a lot of times we think that because someone stands up amongst us, like Obama, and makes these promises about how we can move together as a nation and do A, B, C, and D, okay? And then when he becomes president, he bails out the banks, he bails out the insurance companies, he bails out everybody, the car industry, and then when it comes to you and me, it's like, hey, you know what? We got to rethink this tax rebate. Well, you didn't rethink that crap when you was bailing out. And now you know the banks are back in the black again. They're getting, $10 million parachutes. They're back at it again. No shame. I mean, it's so embarrassing that the president got to come out and chastise you. Damn, man, could y'all do something to cover something? Keep this under wraps. Why y'all got to come out and do it like this? After I gave you all this money. After he done printed all this money. And remember, he printed it. He printed it. Printed it, as in print on paper, fiat capital. And there's never been a historical moment in which fiat capital has ever, ever not collapsed. Now all this money he done printed, somebody got to pay to the piper. Because if you got these billions and billions of dollars in notes, and you don't have absolute, the Chinese got more U.S. dollars than we got. If you print all of this money, what happens after you print all of this money? What do they call it? So what's the next phase we're going to go through? But it's going to have a different name. You know? And you're going to have Greenspan talking about it. I didn't see that. I really thought that if we stimulated the... This is Greenspan. I mean, anybody else... I mean, you know, if he was in Syria, they would have put him on trial and shot him. They would have said he sabotaged the government. He sabotaged the economy. You know? Here we got all these experts that know absolutely jack doo-doo about what they're doing. But we think they're all experts. It's like we think the CIA knows everything. You know, anytime when people rise up in Iran, it's the CIA. The CIA did it. The CIA made them do it. The CIA did this. The CIA did this. Everybody thinks white folks are so sharp that they on top of everything everywhere, and people ain't got a mind of their own. When you look at the situation that we're in, we are in the situation precisely because the white boys sitting up in Washington are they clueless. Look at Iran. What happened with Iran? You had an old man take over from who? The Shah, and they slept. They all slept. They didn't even know this was going to happen. They didn't think it was going to happen like that. Here was a person that they had set up in a region to be their surrogate power. All of his military gear, all of his military equipment, all of that stuff that he had, the United States and the West had given it to him. He created this police state. And in the blink of an eye, an old man with audio tapes overthrew it. And they said, well, how did that happen? But the point is that this was the first time in modern history that an ideology other than Marxism or Leninism or secular ideology.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian radio for the fourth world.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
Tansa toya kakyo ni wakuma akantik. Winston Wataninia, Miksuachi, Saskatchewan, Utsian.
I am Winston Watini. I am from Saskatchewan.
Knowledge is power. We must gather knowledge to protect our children, our culture, our future. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Teach others what you have learned. Together, we can make a difference.
Idle No More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It should be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Ideology had overthrew a modern state. And the CIA, MI5, all of them slept. And they've been playing catch-up ever since. U.S. policy towards Iran, U.S. policy towards Iraq is catch-up policy. Based on that misunderstanding or failure to perceive what was happening in that region. Changed the whole political paradigm. Changed the whole geopolitical paradigm. So it becomes necessary, therefore, for every black politician to get on a plane and fly to Tel Aviv. Have you ever noticed that? Every black congressional, I don't know if my brother over here made his trip yet. Every black politician. He made his trip. He's on
the road. Wait a minute. Since you're calling on me, brother.
Not you, yeah, you're
calling on me. I've also been to Gaza.
They let you in, though, didn't they?
Wouldn't it be better if I didn't go in?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't want me to go to Gaza. So you actually,
no, I'm telling you, you know why I tell you it would have been better if you didn't go?
The people I talked to wanted me there, wanted me to bring
the
their
people
story
in
back.
Gaza want everybody here.
So why shouldn't I go to try to bring their story?
Nobody said you shouldn't go. You said it would have been better if I didn't get in. That's what you said.
No, I said if I didn't go.
No, you said it would have been better if I didn't get in.
I said, no, do you want a somatic thing?
Okay, fine. It would have been better if you didn't get in. Now, if it would have been good if you went and you didn't get in.
Well, I'm glad I did go and I'm going back.
Well, I know you go back, and I know you'll get in.
Well, the thing is, man, is that if you've been, I remember sitting down with you when I was a law student about 20 years ago.
Oh, and this is what happened?
You know what? I'm not taking it personally. I'm taking it
seriously. I'm only joking. I'm only adding some humor.
Okay. And so I'm taking it seriously, not personally. And so, look, you know, there's a lot of things I would like to say, you know, to, I think, bring another perspective to the one you just given, but tonight's your night, so I'm just not going to do that.
Every night's my night.
Well, and so...
I mean, you can feel free. I think folks here would be interested in hearing that shit themselves. Well, because you see, the situation here is, the reason why... I mentioned, it wasn't personal at all. The reason why I mentioned it is because when we understand how the opposition works,
yeah,
a lot of time the opposition works by preparing the way with people who have good intentions and that they know have no power. And now that may, you may have had the best of intentions.
So think it through, brother. So what you're saying is, working to change this system with good intentions is ultimately a futile thing to do. I mean, you've made a lot of good critiques.
Is that a question that you're asking me? That statement right there, is working to change the system with good intentions is, what was the final
question? You're saying that's futile? You're saying that we should just not engage? I mean,
that's not the alternative to that. You made a statement. You asked me, was working to change the system with good intentions futile? Yes.
Well, I don't agree with that. And so, you know, I think that you lead people down a path where they feel nothing's going to... You said once you know something, you either have to do something about it or you have to admit you don't care. That's wrong. People know that there's something going on, but they don't feel they have the power to do anything about it. It's not a matter of not caring. It's a matter of not having the power to do it. And so, you know,
So you feel that you're empowering people?
I feel that I'm trying to do the best I can with what I have. And so, look, you, I mean, but I don't know. I mean, think about you, man. You haven't brought about socialist nirvana in America either.
I'm not a socialist.
Well, whatever kind of world you're trying to bring
about. And I'm not trying to bring about socialism.
You and I have been.
Let me be clear about my motives here.
Right.
My motives are very simple. Ain't nothing complicated about me. You know, I don't like oppressors. I don't like exploiters. Wait a minute, let me finish. I'm coming.
Right.
I don't like tyrants. I don't like oppressors. Huh? That's why I spent 19 years in prison. I didn't spend 19 years in prison because I felt that I had good intentions and I was going to try to change the system. I know the nature of tyrants. I know the nature of oppressors. It's right there in history books. I know their nature. You will not change them with good intentions. The only way
you're not trying to change them.
No, wait a minute. No, you have to get rid of them. And the only way you're going to get rid of them is really pure and simple. You got to knock them out the box. And not by voting. You ain't going to get them out the box by voting. You're going to get another Obama. Don't tell me that this Negro that became president, that promised these people all of this bullshit, had good intentions, and now we're going to fuck with the president. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that. Because that would be a lie. That would be a lie. So what I'm trying to say to you, my opposition, the way I deal with this, the way I deal with tyrants and oppressors, I speak out directly to them. I challenge them directly. And if they want to get physical, I get with that too. Okay? So it's all, that's what it's all about. Because don't think that those 19 years that I had in prison, that them crackers couldn't have murdered me anytime they felt like it. They could have did that. They could have bumped me right off. But they didn't. I'm here talking to you. And why do you think that is?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah.
Why do I think...
How do you think I wound up in this place talking to you at this moment in time?
Is that a cosmic question? Or
you can take it as a cosmic, and it's subjective, it's an ontological question.
Well,
there ain't nothing cosmic about it.
Well, I mean, here's how I answer your question. First of all, you know, much of the critique that you have, I'm not here to dispute. You know, but I think that at the end of the day, if all you have is a complaint,
I just explained to people that the only way that we can begin.
I was sitting here listening to you. You kept up with. You know what? I'm not up here.
I know what people are thinking, but it's not. I know it's not that. I'm saying, just finish what you said.
No. Okay, so how much, do I get a moment to talk, or are you
going to... Go ahead, what you're saying.
Well, first of all, let me just start off with the first thing, one of the first things you said, which is that the reason that that Obama is in there is because he's more white than black.
No, that's not what I said.
Well, he had more in common with whites than blacks. What about this? What about this reason? What about maybe... given 30, 40 years of flat wages, given the social decline of the meaning of whiteness, that now whites have enough opportunity to have more in common with people of color, which allows them to...
I do believe that. You do?
I believe it. Wait a minute, that's the game though, man.
But go ahead, tell me why you said something. I'm sorry.
When you say a bunch of things, provocative things, anybody says something back, you attack.
Go ahead.
No, because you went on for about 2 hours.
I'm right.
And then you don't let me say nothing.
No, go ahead.
And I'm gonna tell you this. You either gonna let me say something or not, but I'm not gonna stand here and let you just.
No, go ahead.
Well, look, the fact is that there's always been, and I think you would agree, a number of interracial collections of people fighting to change oppression. This was going on in the 20s. It was going on in the 30s. It was going on in the 1860s. So you can't say. You said when you made the point. Hey, look. You people, you went over the you people comment, and you said that this person who said this to you felt that there was some impenetrable barrier between you and them. You seem to be saying the same thing. The fact is, you know, people have more in common than they ever had before. When the fact is that we don't have segregation, we don't have Jim Crow segregation anymore. We have had a flattening of wages of everybody. We have seen deindustrialization. and everybody is concerned about it, and people want to do something about it. It's true, black unemployment is higher than white unemployment, but white unemployment officially is 9.7%, which is Depression-era unemployment, which means that there's a broad dissatisfaction, and therefore a basis for people coming together. And it's happened all over the place. I mean, the fact is, I know how you feel about elections, but if there are any measure of what people want and people are doing what they think is right, you're seeing black politicians being elected by majority white districts all the time. And you're seeing something else, too. You're seeing even white politicians being elected, electing white politicians to speak to their issues. Take, for example, a guy named Steve Cohen in Memphis. His voting record is way more progressive than Harold Ford's is. And he actually introduced a resolution, was a chief author to apologize for slavery. Now, I'm not trying to tell you everything he ever did or everything he ever said is great. I'm simply saying that to argue that there is some impenetrable barrier between people with different racial groups, and that the only reason that Obama was elected is because he has more in common with whites, is a mistaken idea, and it's not true. The reason people voted for Obama is because he offered them an opportunity and a stark departure from Bush-era politics. And that people felt in Iowa and a lot of other places that, you know what, I'm really ready for something new, and I'm not focused on this man's melanin. I'm focused on what I believe might happen if I make a different choice. So that's one thing, to just start out talking about one basic flaw in your whole presentation. The other thing is you've got a lot of negative things to say about the Black Caucus, but who was the person who voted against Bush's authorization for war right after 9/11? Well, that was Barbara Lee, who's the chair of the Black Caucus.
The only one.
I wasn't there yet. Okay. Well, I know. I'm there, Steve. I know what I'm talking about.
Michael.
Okay. Well, whatever. And so, let me just also say that when you talk about people standing up for the people of Palestine, you know, most of the people who stood up to fight against the condemnation of the Goldstone Report, Black Caucus highly overrepresented. Myself, Barbara Lee, Maxine Waters, many others. Look at the numbers. We got 58 people who said we are not going to denounce this report, and many of them. Then the other thing is, we got about 54 members to stand up to write a letter to the president saying you must open Gaza. You have to open it up now.
Where's your letter?
Well. What do you mean, where's it? You mean, where, do I have it on me?
What happened to it?
Well, we're pushing it. Can you help? I mean,
I ain't helping y'all do nothing.
Well, that's, well, exactly. But see, but exactly, you ain't helping.
But I'm going to tell you why.
No, exactly, you ain't. You're not helping because you want to promote cynicism.
No.
And I'm trying to promote social change and economic change for people.
Okay.
And so you want to make people feel nothing can go well, and I feel that it can't go well if we come together and are consistent and persistent. It's not true that when Americans have come together in the past that we have not been able to change this country in a better direction. And it's also not. And it's also,
what has that been, though? Give me an example of when folks came together in the past and they changed.
Jim Crow, not Jim Crow.
Tell me when the country came together and changed.
I never said that the country came together.
I said
people.
Tell me when the people in America came together and changed something.
Not all of them did.
I didn't ask you that. I just made a statement. Give me a historical moment when he did that.
Well, it was over a range of years. It wasn't all
of
them.
Just give me one of them.
Well, let's start from 1954 till 1965.
And that's supposed to be a period when people in America came together to change something.
When some people in America came together and changed the country, right? Now, I don't even think you can deny that we're better off without Jim Crow, right? I don't even think you would say that, would you? Are you going to say that Jim Crow would be better if we still had it? Or what would you say?
That's not the issue.
Well, it is in part the issue. Here's why it is.
But first of all, that's not the
whole Let me tell you why I think it is at least in part the issue. Then I'm going to be quiet. You can finish your comment. Because you correctly identify American foreign policy as a very dangerous thing for the people of the world. I think you're right about that. In fact, I think if we come together and we put up a strong opposition to this imperialist...
Who's with?
Well, the people in this room, for
example. Oh, okay, that's cool.
Right? And more than just this room. Way more than just this room.
You gotta have more than this room.
Right. Yeah. But people who would rather be a part of humanity than above it. You know, and I think there's a lot of Americans who want to see the world that changed that way, who want to reach out across the water, who want to reach out and internationally. But if you just say that everything sucks and everything's bad and nothing ever going to happen, then you know what? Then we will capitulate with the system and the worst elements of it. But if we believe, and if people like you would use your voice to say, you know what? What we need to do is not just buy canned goods for the next storm, but actually organize to really oppose. Let's start with Gaza, but then the whole policy over there. Maybe we can get ourselves together. But the movement, in my opinion, stays on the margin, and because it stays on the margin, we don't ever reach into issues of power to really change, make the changes that I think we could make. So you know, I'm gonna tell you honestly, I just came to listen tonight, and if you would have been signifying on me, I wouldn't have said a word. We've got to get comfortable with trying to acquire some power, because we've been dogged by power, we're so distrustful of it, we act like we don't even want it, and it always gets used on us. And so what I'm saying is, right now, you asked me about Mumia Abu-Jamal. Yeah. You know, you put something on my mind tonight. You really did.
Oh,
and we'll see what happens tonight. Well, let me tell you, people in this room have to admit, I have always consistently opposed the death penalty, without exception. Right? Without ever any exception. Now, I'm going to tell you, you want something done on Mumia Abu-Jamal? Let's begin that conversation. Frankly, I'll be honest. I haven't really even thought about it. Okay? About a resolution in Congress raising questions about Mumia Abu-Jamal and saying there must be an investigation on this case. I haven't really even thought about it. But I'm going to walk out of this room thinking about it. In the same way that I brought other resolutions and done other things, including impeachment, including stuff on detention. I've been down in Guantanamo to address these issues. But I'm not going to stop. And it's not going to be an overnight thing. But one thing I'm not going to do is stand on the sideline and talk about everything sucks and how everything's bad and how nothing ever works. Because that doesn't lead nowhere. And I'm telling you, man, I love your critique. And I took notes on what you were saying.
See, I ain't taking no notes of what you just said.
But it's okay, and I'm not gonna let you insult because
I'm not insulting you. That's not an insult.
But the point is that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this your crowd, you're gonna say what you wanna say.
Hey, I'm gonna say what I wanna say if this wasn't my crowd. Don't get this twisted.
Well, I'm going to tell you this. I've been there 3 years, and I haven't heard from you there.
You know why? Because before you got there, I stopped singing to the Negroes.
Well, there's new Negroes, okay? And you can come talk to
the Negroes. I only know old Negroes.
Well,
that's like Puff Daddy with his
family. I'm using your word. I'm using your word. You said Negro. I don't like the term, but that's what you said, so whatever. There are new people every day who are looking for constructive ways to move forward with some action. You know, what you say is, I'm done talking to them.
Then obviously, that's not what I said.
That's not
a mischaracterization. I'll tell you what I said. I didn't say that there's this impenetrable divide between people in this country. What I said was is that this nation is an empire in denial. Okay? And the major contradiction in this country, the major contradiction between people in this country is their inability to face history and face up to the realities of their historical beliefs. Okay? That's the contradiction. White folks in America don't want to admit to their history. They clean it up, they modify it, they don't want to deal with it. And as long as they don't want to deal with it, the issues never get dealt with. It's nothing about being impenetrable. It has to deal with people being ignorant and wallowing in that ignorance because they prefer it. And because that's part of the national characteristic, to be an ignorant ass. That's what Americans are, ignorant. If you go to Cuba or any place else and you compare junior high school students with their knowledge of the world and American high school students, you'll be shocked. It's ignorance. It's studied ignorance. And what I want to say is this. No one said that the divide between black and white is impenetrable. But you got to remember, there's not one historical moment in this country where white folks in mass came on board for a just cause that had to deal with black people. Not one historical moment. Not one.
That's right.
That's why you can't name one. Well, everything. That's why you use the word some. That's why you use the word some. You said some people. And those some people are some of the same people that's in jail right now as political prisoners. Those are the some people. The same ones. Okay? The ones that's sitting up, my comrades that's dead. Those were the some people that came together to change this. And the fact of the matter is, when a black person gets murdered in Chicago, when a black kid gets shot down by the cops in New York City, you don't see white folks coming out demonstrating horrified over what happened. They don't come out. And the reason why they don't come out?
Do we organize
the reason why they don't, what?
Do we organize them?
Yes! Yes! Yes, they don't come out. The reason why they don't come out is because they don't identify with what's happening. And they don't identify with what's happening. This is something that you really got to deal with. Okay, and the black politicians don't want to deal with. Okay, the fact of the matter is that the United States is a nation state. It's a national security state that evolved on the proposition and the premise of white supremacy. And they have never confronted that historical contradiction. And
as long as they don't... What I'm saying to you is...
Wait a minute now, you try to point out... I'm coming to that part. You said that the reason why people voted for Obama, I'm just capsulizing this because you mentioned a number of points. You mentioned a number of points. I'm capsulizing this. I'm saying that up front because you mentioned a number of points that I would like to address individually, but you know it was a little bit much. But you said, in capitalization, that there was a level of discontent and disconcertedness in the country as a whole amongst white folks who felt that they were ready for a change that this man represented. That's an encapsulization, basically, of what you said. Okay? That's basically what you said. And I'm saying to you that if you go back and you read Du Bois, if you go back and you read Mao, if you go back and you read all of the historical analysis of American society, okay, you find, and this was the major contradiction of the Communist Party of the USA and why they failed. Because you got to remember, one of the foremost advocates against racism and discrimination in early America were the communists in this country. White communists. Okay? So for you to tell me that I think that there's some impenetrable barrier between white folks and black folks.
About what you said.
That's not what I said. I didn't say nothing about an impenetrable barrier. I talked about the dichotomy and the dialectics of the situation. Nobody said it was impenetrable. Anything man creates, he could uncreate. Okay? But what you were trying to point out was that there were a whole bunch of demographic factors. There were a whole bunch of sociological and political factors. Urbanization, for instance. We've inherited obsolete urban infrastructures. Through migration. How did migration proceed in the U.S. from the south to the north? When did it proceed? At what point in capitalist production did it succeed? All these issues that you were talking about at the top were symptoms of what happened at the bottom. And the bottom line of this is that African-American workers and white workers in this country have a different historical destiny. They have a different historical formula for their resolution of their contradiction. It's not the same. The black experience in America is not the same as the white experience in America. And that dichotomy is not impenetrable. That dichotomy relies on sincerity and truth. That only when you have a truthful dialogue Only when you have a truthful dialogue can people come together and say, wait, I can see where you're coming from. And they can say, well, damn, man, well, let's work together on this. That requires a truthful dialogue. And what I'm trying to say to you is that the majority of people that you got in the Black caucus today and the majority of Black leaders of today are not involved or want to be involved in a truthful dialogue. That's not their purpose. Their purpose is to get paid. The basic purpose is to get paid. Because every time, you can tell me that's not true, but everyone I ran into, whenever the tire hits the road, it's about getting paid. It's about getting reelected and getting paid. Now, you're talking about entrees to power. You're talking about entrees to power and how to move on power. I'll give you a good example. When I was in prison, when I went to prison in 71 for the pastor on this conspiracy case, there were hardly any black correction officers in the Department of Corrections. After we tore up the prisons and you had Attica and Auburn riots, and George Jackson was murdered in California, and you had black inmates agitating for unions, black inmates organizing unions, before you realized that criminal justice was an industry. Criminal justice in America is an industry, and it applies on a commodity, and the commodity is this, black flesh. Okay? Before there was these correction officers, there was these white correction officers. That's all these guys was up there. Then they started getting all these black correction officers in after Adams. Because one of the major demands is that the prison guards had nothing in common with the prisoners, and it was this disconnect, this impenetrable barrier between guard and inmate, sociologically, politically, and everything. The black officers come in, and in order for them to fit into the system, they gotta be as much like the white officers as possible. They got to engage in the goon squad beat-ups. They got to do all of that stuff. They got to harass your people. They got to do everything that the system does, okay? And although every time you ask them why they're there, they want to make a difference. They want to change this. So I asked one guard one time, I said, look, you know, you're always telling me about how you're in this to change the system, how you want to work. I said, what if, you know, I was trying to escape? And there was nothing between me and freedom but you and your gun and that tower. Would you shoot me? You know what he told me? What do you think he told me?
You wouldn't tell a story unless it had a certain outcome.
I'm asking you, what do you think the answer would be?
Man, it's your story to tell.
The answer was, and he was in a dilemma. But this guy is a genuinely nice guy. This dude ain't no evil person that was in this thing, you know, to glory over people being locked up. This wasn't a guy like that. So this was a guy that was, you know, kind of thoughtful. I said, so would you shoot me? You know what he said? He said, if my job didn't depend on it, no. So I'm telling you, that tells you. That tells me, that told me then. Okay? That told me then. That you can go into an institution, you know, you can go into an institution with the best of intentions as an individual to make the most, to make the best change and have and effectuate the most change and find yourself in an institution that will completely neutralize you and spit you out like a piece of doodles. Your point was, okay, that we should be involved in the process of empowerment. That we should try to get involved in the process of empowerment from the inside, you understand, in order to facilitate change. And I'm saying that the system relies on you having that idea that you go inside of it and change it, and it will change you before it will change. And the change was not Martin Luther King inside the system. It will change America. And you've got a point when you say that there's a lot of us who organize on the outside are really afraid of the authority or the position of power. Then once we get power, we won't know what to do with it. It's easy for us to sit outside and throw stones, but once you get inside, you have to make decisions. It's a different can of worms. Okay, and that's true. That's why you see every revolutionary government on the African continent, once it became one into power, the elites in those revolutionary parties became the same forces to oppress and exploit and marginalize the people. ANC, PAIGC, FRELIMO, all of them organizations are now parties of the institutional powers in those countries. And if you go talk to those people in Mozambique, in South Africa, you find out that nothing has significantly changed in their lives from these people. Why? Because a nation lives in the community of nations. Okay? No matter what your intentions are, when you came into power, if you came into power as a revolutionary movement, once you became a nation state, you had to deal with all the other nation states of the world. And that means that a lot of your radical ideas had to change. That means you had to administer power a certain way. Nelson Mandela didn't go from prison to president by accident. He went from prison to president by design. And he was meeting, and Nelson will tell you this, he was meeting with the financiers of Europe a year and a half, 18 months before he got out of prison. So what I'm trying to say to you is that your role in the Congress, your role in the Congress, your intentions may be to work inside of this system and with people who have common interests and better the lives of these folks through trying to bring through those sincere legislations and those sincere policies that will address people's needs. That's what you basically are there for. You're not there to get paid, to get rich. That's what you're saying. Fine, I hear it. But I'm saying the system needs you inside to do that in order to do what it's doing. The real way the change comes in this country is not from within. The real way the change came in this country historically has been from without. And it's been from organizing from without.
It is, you don't leave an opportunity to work power on the table. What I'm talking about is a mass movement. I am talking about, I don't believe you can change an institution from within by yourself. Of course you cannot do that. Of course that institution will work on you like sand works on a stump. And over time, if you don't have a mass movement driving, you're connected with
it. You just answered your own question.
Well, what I'm saying is you say only without. I'm not saying only within. I'm saying that there is a ton of things that you left out that are important to know, and that if all you do is tell people that, you know, the revolutionary movement gets in power, then becomes just like the institution that tried to
overcome. But there's a reason for that.
Then my answer to you is, what are we going to do about it?
Okay.
There will be.
You want me to answer that question?
Go for it.
Please do.
What we do about it. Let me give you an example. When the Black Panther Party in 68 called for a People's Constitutional Convention, 69, I'm sorry, 69, 70, we called for a People's Constitutional Convention. Okay, because we were naive. Okay? Because at that particular historical moment, you had a massive anti-war movement in the United States. Okay? White kids were going to Canada to avoid the draft. It was this massive anti-war sentiment in the United States. Over 70%, 65% of the people in the U.S. was against the Vietnam War. Okay? At the same time, you had the Black Power movement, the Black Civil Rights movement, which was causing massive social change and upheaval in the country. So you had this historical moment, okay, where the Panther Party said, well, damn, let's get all of the progressive people in the country together and go for a constitutional convention. Let's ratify a progressive outline for a constitution. Take this back to our local constituency and see if we can work on this constitutional measure to change the constitution in ways that reflected the needs of people at that particular point in history. White people, yellow people, brown people, all of these folks. If you know anything about the history of the Black Panther Party, you know that the initiative, that's where my ideology began, but you know that we never talked about the inseparability of race. You knew that. The Rainbow Coalition, the idea, the notion of the Rainbow Coalition came from the Black Panther Party, not Jesse Jackson.
That's what I surprised you.
So therefore for you to misconstrue what I'm saying to see.
I was surprised to hear you say what you said, which is because I know that.
Well, if you knew that, then you knew what I was saying wasn't that.
Maybe you changed.
Maybe I changed.
Yeah.
If I don't think so. I think that if I change, everybody changes. I think if I change, I've become more radical. But what I'm trying to point out here is that when we look at the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act didn't occur from within. It didn't occur from within. It came from without. You see? None of these historical changes that you cited came about as a result of the goodwill of people inside of government. It didn't come about because of that.
I don't need to interrupt. I just need to let folks know before people start in mass numbers. We did not have to cover the cost of food tonight. A lot of people breezed by us or didn't pay. So I realized that it was $5 or whatever you can do. If you could throw a little bit more in there, that would be really appreciated because...
Just remember, when you bring up when we meet in the Black Caucus,
What's that?
No, I'm telling you, brother, when you bring up Omia and the Black Caucus, don't be surprised if everybody look at you like you're crazy. Everybody in there knows about Omia.
I'll get word back to you.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. Give Bobby Rush my regards.
Omia, I'll put you back.
Wait. Don't forget the pony offer, guys.
Not only that, please don't be. I'll say something. Yeah, what's that? You'll hear from me out with your mail.
Okay. Thank you.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a travel ban aimed at Muslims, a wall on the Mexican border, an attempt to outlaw sanctuary cities. Every day of the Trump administration brings new reason to protest. But the mass arrest of hundreds of people protesting the inauguration, including legal observers and journalists, reminds us that the right to speak up still needs protection. We'll hear from activist and attorney Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice.